The small brown mouse named Ralph, who was hiding under the grandfather clock, did not have much longer to wait before he could ride his motorcycle. The clock had struck 8 already, and then 8:30. Ralph was the only mouse in the Mountain View Inn, a rundown hotel in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, who owned a motorcycle. It was a mouse-sized red motorcycle, a present from a boy named Keith who had been a guest in room 215 over the 4th of July weekend. Ralph was proud of his motorcycle, but his brothers and sisters said he was selfish.
You just heard the opening lines to Beverly Cleary's Runaway Ralph. I'm John McCoy.
I'm Phil Gonzalez.
And this is Clickacast, a Beverly Cleary podcast. So, we've reached the 70s.
Oh boy, have we. 70s we've reached. It's like she hits the ground running. She's like, well, I guess it's the 70s. I guess I've got to start dealing with psychological issues.
I'm reading from a mid-90s paperback, which maintains all the typography from the original books. So all the headers are in a lovely Cooper Black.
Yes. They look like they're going to be ironed right onto a t-shirt. No, I have an edition. My edition's from 1998, and it still has that typeset. So,
do you still have the Lois Starling illustrations?
Yeah.
Well, that's good, because this book is dedicated to Mr. Lois Starling.
Yeah, that would be a shame if they were cut.
It's a sad thing when you open up this book and you see the first thing you see is to Lois Starling, 1916 to 1970.
To Lois Starling, 1916, 1917. I didn't realize he died so young. What was he like? It was 54. Yeah. Well, we started this one off on a sad note.
Yes. Well, let's back up, because this is a happy story about.
Is it? Because really, is it?
Mice running away from home and almost being eaten by cats.
I think it was a bold choice for Beverly Cleary to write a book about camp in which everyone hates camp.
Yeah.
It portrays it as something of a humorless, miserable place for a child and an animal to be.
When did Hello, Mother, Hello, Father come out?
Well, that would have been late 60s, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So this is like the hating camp is in the air, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, like the hippie movement kind of ruined all the outdoorsy stuff for the squares. I do want to start off by saying that we got in a little bit of trouble for our previous Ralph S. Mouse episode.
Oh yes,
a couple of listeners took exception to our critical appraisal of the novel.
You know, I don't think we were actually that critical. I think what happens is when you pull these things out one by one, you remember what happens in each book in turn, and you kind of look at the book on its own merits. I have a feeling that by the time we get done with Runaway Ralph, I will have more affection for the series than I have for any particular book in the series.
Well, and also, like, if we're trying to take a look at these books within the context of her career, and I think a lot of our response to it was how these mouse books just don't seem to fit any other thread in any of her, like, in any of the trends of her writing. So they just sort of seem really strange and incongruous and just kind of weird. They're kind of weird books.
You know, one thing I have noticed, though, now that I have read a lot of Beverly Cleary, is she had a tendency to have characters bicker a lot.
Yes.
What was the... I'm sorry, I'm already blanking on it. The novel about the twins.
Mitch and Amy?
Mitch and Amy had just featured constant bickering.
That was literally chapters full of bickering.
And Ribsy had bickering from the peripheral human characters. It seems to be a mode she goes into very quickly. Now, maybe I'm just an old man whose kids have all grown up and left home. But I don't remember childhood being so full of that much bickering. So this book opens with a scene of familial conflict.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, it opens with Ralph zooming around the...
of course.
The hotel, happiest being a loner, you know. The other thing that's funny about this is a book about a mouse who finds solace out on the open road, being by himself. Biker culture grew out of World War II and on into the early 70s, when I think it was at its height, But you know, Ralph isn't a he isn't a biker per se, but he shares a little bit of that desire to get out, and the only place you can find yourself is when you're alone.
This book makes sense in the context of the late 60s, early 70s, because that definitely was the era of like kids rejecting their family's values, leaving home with nothing but a dollar and a dream, I don't know how else to put it, hopping on the motorbike and like setting off into the open country, and then of course getting in a lot of trouble and running back home at the end. Yeah, the book starts out almost like a road trip, because like a road movie, because he gets on his bike and he has a few little adventures before he actually makes it to the camp. And on this current reread, I was almost wishing we had spent more time. Well, I was wishing we had spent more time on Ralph on the open road, because that's kind of Ralph in his element, where he's on his bike. What it ends up becoming is almost like a retelling of The Great Escape.
He spends a lot of this book in a cage, and he spends a lot of this book discussing the meaning of life with a hamster in the cage next to him.
Yeah, a very strange character for a Beverly Cleary novel.
But we may be getting ahead of ourselves here. Maybe we should go with the opening sequence, because the opening sequence is in the hotel, the self-same Mountain View Inn that is just as dilapidated as it was in the last book.
Yes.
And we get to see a little bit more of Ralph's extended family. We've met his mom in the last book, who's constantly worrying over Ralph's safety. Now we get treated to Uncle Lester.
Now, Uncle Lester was a character in the last book.
Oh, he was too? Okay, I can't remember.
Yeah, he wasn't in it much, but he was kind of like the guy who was always standing behind his mom's shoulder yelling at Ralph.
Well, of course, Ralph's dad sadly got poisoned eating a stray pill.
Yes.
Which is pretty horrific for Beverly Cleary. And Uncle Lester is the stand-in paternal figure. He doesn't like Ralph zipping around the place on his motorcycle, but on the other hand, he wants Ralph to share his motorcycle with the kids.
You get the feeling that it's not just that he doesn't want to waste all of his time giving rides to his little brothers and sisters, but he also, like, it's that whole thing where it's like he's found something cool that defines him, and as soon as younger kids start adopting that, the coolness starts wearing off. And he has to sort of ramp up what he's going to do with his lifestyle. He's more than content to just putter around the inn for a while. But it's this intrusion of his family on his new, like, this is who I am, man, like, lifestyle that prompts the events of the book.
Now, also in this first chapter, we get introduced to the main human of the book, Garf.
Garf. That's kind of a perfect name for this child.
Now, Garf is on his way. His family's just here for a day before Garf goes off to camp, which made me think, how far is he traveling to get to camp if the family has to stay overnight just to get there? That seems like a really far away camp. The parents must be really wanting to get rid of Garf.
I mean, I think of camps. I mean, again, I was not a camp goer, but I know that like many camps that my friends went to were several hours away from where we lived. So I guess like if they have to drive him out there, maybe they don't want to have to drive back at night.
Yeah.
Like I assume that they drive him there. They have like their like family orientation probably like first thing in the morning, and then they leave. So, I mean, to me, it makes sense. Like, you don't want to be, like, you don't have to get up at 2 in the morning to get your kid there by 8 or whatever. So, I don't know. I'm sympathizing way too much with Garf's semi-nameless parents.
So, he's on his way to Happy Acres Camp, which
sounds like a retirement home.
Yeah, exactly. And it's close enough to the inn that the mice can hear them playing taps.
That's something that stuck out to me, because I kept being confused as to how far away this camp was. Because Ralph says, like, he could hear, like, children, like, laughing and playing. And I'm like, well, is this camp just around the corner? But then it becomes quite obvious that it's not. It's like a mile or so away.
Well, the mountain air is playing tricks on you. And in any case, Garf doesn't want to go to camp. And Ralph wants nothing more than to leave home.
Yeah.
So they're at cross purposes as the book starts. And there is a return of Matt, the elderly bellboy, bellhop. I don't know what you'd call him. The guy who is in the guy who really a hotel that is this dilapidated. There's no way they can afford to pay an aging gentleman to putter about the place.
I have a feeling they pay him a lot of like in room and board. Like, I have a feeling that either that or he is actually a ghost.
Well, he could be a ghost. He's the one grown-up who can talk to mice. And he talks to Ralph on Ralph's way out the door. And
kind of.
we were talking a little bit at the front here about this. He's pretty... He doesn't really try to stop Ralph in any way in his attempt to run away from home.
Well, it's not just that he doesn't try to stop Ralph. It's that Ralph needs help getting down the stairs. And Matt's like, I can't help you. And Ralph's like, what? How come? And he's like, then you'd be depending on me. And you want to be independent. So you can't depend on me. And I'm like, well, dude, like, I thought you were his friend. I mean, on the other hand, I could see like maybe Matt's like, if I don't help him, he won't be able to leave. And then maybe he'll be sick. I don't know. Maybe he's like hoping that Ralph will just give up and stay at the hotel because Matt doesn't want Ralph to go out and get eaten by a bird.
Yeah. Well, the thing that's funny is he plays it really cool and he plays it really like, well, do it yourself. And then when he leaves, when Ralph finally gets out the door, He hears Matt from outside saying, the little fellow must have managed to get his motorcycle down the steps somehow. Now maybe I can get some sleep. It's like, Matt may be a jerk, but...
He just may be a jerk. He may. I think that's the point you're getting at.
Right.
Matt may actually be a jerk.
Yeah.
Now, there was a TV movie version of this made in which Matt is not as much of a jerk.
Right.
Played by Ray Walston, I believe.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah.
Who I think is incapable of playing a true jerk, I think.
No, Ray Walston had a career of playing people who were gruff and a bit unapproachable, and then you get to learn about them and you start to admire them.
Right.
That was his whole shtick. I remember him playing a character like that on Northern Exposure.
Right. I think he also played a character like that in The Stand.
Right.
Two stories that are very unlike Runaway Ralph. this is an interesting book in that, I mean, like the previous book, there's a young boy who is kind of Ralph's focus. But unlike the previous book, Ralph doesn't interact that much with this young boy. Like, that's not the central relationship in this book.
Yeah, but what is the central relationship of this book? Is it with Ralph and himself? Yeah. He has this... He gets captured rather quickly in the book, and then he gets stuck in a cage, and he talks to his neighbor, a hamster in a cage next to him, but they never really become close.
Uh-huh.
Looking back on this book, it's an oddly static book through a lot of it.
It's episodic, but also not very... Like, usually an episodic story, there's like changes of location or changes of like their little stories taken within. But like, this is mostly just Ralph in kind of his own head. And a lot of it, he's not even trying to escape. He's just getting used to being in a cage.
So, but first he runs away and he goes out on the open road.
Yeah.
Heading down the highway, looking for adventure. And he. You mentioned earlier that the 60s into the 70s was this time about youthful rebellion. It also reminds me that when I was a kid, I read so many stories about kids running away. That seemed to be like a plot device that was everywhere. And it was in like Disney made for TV movies and stuff like that. Kids just ran away. And the grown-ups, quite often the grown-ups around them sort of saw it as, oh, well, they got to work this out for themselves in some way, you know, like they'll be back and they'll learn their lesson.
I mean, I listened to enough true crime podcasts to know that like at a certain era in American history, a kid disappearing was the police would frequently just be like, well, they probably ran away. Yeah. Like, they probably just ran away. And like, well, this is an 11-year-old. It's like, well, yeah, kids sometimes just run away. What can you do? And I think there was that attitude of, like, leftover from, like, the early part of the 20th century where, you know, kids would sometimes just be expected to set out on their own and, like, make a life for themselves.
I can recall a few times in the early 70s myself when I would threaten my parents with running away, and I would go so far as to try to tie myself a bindle. Because I was convinced that if you actually ran away, you had to have a bindle. And I don't know how my parents managed to keep a straight face while I was doing this. Looking back on it now, I would have just laughed and laughed and laughed.
It's not the best way to carry your belongings, A. Like, I had a bindle. I was when I was like 3 or 4, I was a hobo for Halloween.
Yes.
And my mom made me a bindle out of one of her, like, handkerchiefs and a curtain rod. I still remember it was this collapsible curtain rod. So it was a very, like, high-tech bindle.
Right.
But I just remember as a little kid being like, wow, you really can't put a whole lot in a bindle.
Right. And we're getting farther and farther afield from the book. But I do want to point out to our younger listeners out there, back in the 70s, a hobo was like a perennial outfit for Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
When your parents didn't want to spend money on a costume,
but you had a lot of old clothes.
Yeah, you just put on some old clothes, you smudged your face with dirt, you tied up a bindle, and then you had the hilarious and absolutely appropriate costume of a destitute person looking for work.
Yes. I mean, you know, it was the 70s. We were a bit more removed from reality at that point. So Ralph is on, he goes on the open road, and it's tough. It takes him a few days to reach the camp, where he encounters Sam, the watchdog, who's not in the special, if I remember.
I haven't watched this. This is something we're going to differ on. I never watched the special. I was watching the opening just before we started this podcast. Oh. So I've seen up to the point that Ralph heads out on the highway and sings his lovely blues song.
I don't suppose you would sing us any of the blues song.
I've heard it one time, so I don't know. But it's a, you know, basically a 12-bar blues thing. So I'm sure it's like, I'm a mouse on the highway, I'm going on the road. I'm a mouse on the highway, I'm going down the road. The thing that amazes me about Sam, or that I find charming about Sam, is Cleary's in Cleary's world, all the animals speak the same language.
Yeah.
And they all basically, this is Cleary writing in her anthropomorphic mode.
Yes.
Which is an interesting mode, as we've said before, because while the animals have human concerns and human thoughts and complex emotions that are based upon social interactions that we can assume animals probably don't have, her other mode is the mode of Ribsy and of Sox, where she mm-hmm. tries as best she can to really imagine what the phenomenological experience of being an animal is.
Right.
But here, no. Here, it's just like if you took people and you stuck their brains inside animals.
Yeah, but still tried to make human psychology account for the real behaviors of animals. Like, she still has the animals, to a human, to an outside viewer, the animals still seem to be acting like animals, but it's because of human reasons.
Right.
Like, the cat is instructing its young in a very, like, teacherly way on how to capture a mouse. Right. As opposed to, like, I am a cat who is programmed to do this by nature. I don't know how a cat's mind works. I guess in the next book we'll find out how a cat's mind works.
Right. Now, Sam doesn't want to let Ralph in because he takes his role as a watchdog very seriously.
Yeah.
And
I like that he's not... He has this thing of, like, I'm like, I'm really sorry, but I screwed up recently. Like, normally I might let you this slide and let you in, but I've had a screw up recently, so I can't afford to fall asleep on the job again. So I'm just gonna have to be this tough dog. Like, I like that. That's his motivation.
We also get a gopher mm-hmm. who also talks animal speech, and because Ralph hides in the gopher hole for a bit. Now, how is it that he shakes Sam? Is it just that Sam gets called away to something? I forget.
He says, like, if you're a watchdog, watch me. And then he takes a deep breath and just shoots between Sam's legs. Like, he's on the motorcycle so he can evade Sam. And that's how he ends up in the gopher hole. And Sam, like, tries to dig him out of the gopher hole, but he's too far down.
Now, Ralph secrets his motorcycle in a stand of bamboo, which... I was surprised to hear. I didn't think bamboo would be common in, I suppose this is Oregon again, at this time.
I thought, but, no, the Ralph books take place in California, don't they?
Oh, in California. Yeah, okay. But still, are there lots of stands of bamboo in California?
Like, does it grow there?
I mean, I guess
there?
It would grow there, but...
Yeah, of course. Bamboo grows all over California.
I live in the East Coast. I'm an ignorant Bostonian. I don't know what goes on in California.
I guess. Like, I think it does. I assume it does. Like, I assume that Beverly Cleary wouldn't, like, be like, I don't know about this fact, but I'm just going to stick some bamboo. Like, I assume this is based on something she saw. Like, bamboo is a really weird choice otherwise. Yeah. Our listeners, please write in and let us know. In the 1960s, early 70s, was bamboo a thing in California? If you went to camp, were you surrounded by bamboo?
Anyway... He goes to sleep and he wakes up in a waking nightmare. He is being tossed aloft by a cat who is demonstrating to other cats how to terrorize and brutalize mice.
This is like everything he was afraid of.
And it's, I have to hand it to Cleary. She writes this in such an understated way that it's really horrific.
Yeah, no, because the cat is like a true, like, sociopathic, like, character.
Yeah, the cat has absolutely no concern for any of the emotions Ralph is going through. It's the cat is also wants to demonstrate to the other cats how to be as cruel as you possibly can be.
Yeah, Ralph tries to play dead at one point, and the cat says he's trying to play dead. But I can feel his heart beating beneath my paw. And that, to me, is the most chilling line. And there's a great Lewis Darling illustration of the cat just, like, batting Ralph into the air to the amusement of another cat and a group of kittens. And this goes on. This torture goes on for, like, several pages.
And then in comes Garf.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because, like, Garf entered the story in the beginning, and then he just kind of disappeared. Like, they kind of set up that Ralph is going to try to, like, I thought, I always get fooled into thinking that Ralph is going to hitch a ride with Garf, but he doesn't, because this is like a sullen boy who does not talk to mice.
Or anyone.
Yeah.
So Garf captures the mouse, captures Ralph and takes him back to the camp counselor and asks to keep him as a pet, and they set Ralph up in this cage in the crafts cabin right next to a cage that contains a golden hamster
named Chum.
Chum.
Named Chum.
Very strange.
And Chum is one of Beverly Cleary's greatest creations.
You know what Chum reminded me of is
what?
You know, in Watership Down, early on in the book, when the rabbits are trying to find their new place, they come to this warren full of well-fed rabbits who are just sitting around, and they're all sleepy, and all they do is talk poetry, and they create art, and they're decadent, and it turns out that they are being farmed by the farmer and being picked off one by one as they and so they live this kind of an artificial life.
Yeah.
And Chum also lives an artificial life. He's adapted to being in a cage, and he's accepted his role in a cage, and that makes him in some ways reflective and moody, and he he gets Ralph to investigate his feelings on his own life, but he's also, he lacks any kind of ambition or any kind of drive, and he certainly does not care about getting out of this cage.
Right. He's developed, he's taught himself tricks that'll get him more food because he hates alfalfa pellets. So he'll like, the kids will stuff his cheeks full of sunflower seeds, and that's how he like gets more sunflower seeds. He's completely cage trained. And so in the late 60s movie of this book, if this was a motorcycle story, this would be the motorcycle guy gets arrested by the kindly sheriff, but he's still arrested and thrown in jail. And in the next cell would be the guy who's just sort of a career criminal who's just been in jail now or is in prison and is completely institutionalized. And this is where your hero learns that this can't be the life for him, because this guy is kind of weird and not the kind of person he wants to be.
Yeah.
And we get this, Beverly Cleary's first real use of, like, here comes the arrow, like symbolism, with a mouse wheel, with Ralph Ralph learning to love running on the mouse wheel until it's pointed out that it's not getting him anywhere. And I'm like, ooh.
There is this kind of overt symbolism that runs through this whole long passage of being in prison, but it's also interspliced with fairly mundane slice of life visions of camp life.
Yeah.
One thing that keeps happening over and over again is we keep cutting away to the campers singing camp songs.
Horrible camp songs.
And well, it's delightful to me to see that I grew up with little bunny Foo Foo.
Yeah.
Here it's little rabbit Frou Frou. And I always like to see how these songs have changed over the years or become what regionalisms pop up in them. And there's a gobs and gobs of greasy, grimy gopher guts, which anyone who went to camp probably learned a version of that song.
I learned it from my dad.
Oh,
well, because, So the version in this book is great green gobs of greasy, grimy gopher guts, like simulated monkey meat, chopped up baby parakeet, I think is this version.
Yeah.
And I learned it as great green globs of greasy, grimy gopher guts, mutilated monkey meat, dirty little birdie feet.
Huh.
Yes. So
I learned almost the same thing, but mine was chopped up chicken feet, which gives you the alliteration of this ch sound.
So we got dirty little birdie feet, which has the erdy and erdy rhyme, birdie. which I appreciate.
That's good. That's good.
And this actually serves a plot point, because Ralph is like, maybe I could befriend this Garf boy. He seems like the kind of kid who would love who I'd be able to talk to. But then he overhears Garf singing these songs, and they all involve violence to animals, and it literally horrifies Ralph. He says, "Certainly what kind of boy would sing such a wicked song? Certainly not a boy a mouse could trust, because it sings about scooping up the field mice and banging them on the head." And he gets kind of depressed and disappointed in Garf, which is like such a strange book,
right? And in the meantime, the cat,
right.
His name is, Katso, is slowly picking away at a corner of the screen door and sticking his paw in and trying to widen this hole, which is a vision of mounting horror, basically.
Yes.
This is the kind of slow-moving horror that you get in ghost stories, and it just keeps happening over the course of many chapters.
Yeah, he's being stalked and no one noticed. Like, it's very, the cat isn't subtle about it, but the kids don't notice because the cat's just being a cat. Like, it's this existential horror that only applies to an animal small enough for a cat to kill. Oh, and also, we learn that Garf has kind of a reputation around camp as being like this kid that, like, doesn't participate in anything.
Right.
And doesn't want to be at camp. He's very sullen, and Aunt Jill, like, who's kind of in charge of the camp, is trying to get him like engaged and involved, but like the other kids don't really know him or trust him. he's just such an outsider. He's extremely sullen, and the only thing he wants, like, other kids start feeding Ralph, and he gets like very upset about it.
Right. Now, this is the parallel, of course, between him and Ralph, because he wants this thing to be special all to himself.
Yeah.
It's important to him to be distinctive. It's important for him to have a corner of the world that is his domain. He gets to put a sign on the cage. Again, the sign says, if you feed him, you will drop dead, which Cleary is being a little bit more vicious in this book than she normally is.
This is why in this book I always like felt weird about Garf. I was always like, this is a kid. He's not your typical like just like bored Beverly Cleary kid. He's a different animal. He's closer to like who is Ellen Tebbit's?
Otis Spofford.
He's closer to Otis Spofford in that there's something going on with this kid besides just a misbehaving child. He's got problems at home or something to be acting this way. And unfortunately, you don't really find out what's going on with Garf.
Yeah, you don't. I mean, do we get any hints that there's anything wrong between them and the parents at the beginning?
No, not really. They seem like fine parents. I mean, you know, they're the public face and all. Like, I don't think Beverly Cleary, honestly, is trying to insinuate there's anything horrible going on at the Garf house. But she builds a character who is unusual in his behavior, and there's really no payoff for it.
Yeah, Garf is unusual in his behavior. Ralph is a bit... he's playing the sullen teen.
Yeah.
And his mom is just hectoring him. And everyone else in this book is either an actual threat to Ralph's life or a sort of a symbol of ennui and disillusion. It's an odd book.
Yeah, it's very Candide-esque. Like, you know, it's very much about like Ralph leaving home and then discovering that like home is, you know, like the best of all possible worlds, I guess, if you want to. Because this is the point where he starts like being like, man, I really shouldn't have left home. Like, it's hard out here. And my family, as annoying as they were, they did love me. And, you know, like they were okay people. And so this is around the time when Katso finally gets through the hole in the door. Leading to an incredible chase scene and a bizarre plot twist where the cat steals a watch.
Yes. Now, you sent me a still from the the special showing the cat pouncing this watch. I mean, I've had cats, and they do light on the strangest things. They do decide that this particular object is something that they want. So there's a bit of realism there, but he Casso does end up stealing a watch from one of the girls at camp. Now, it made me think about how much watches meant to me at that age.
Yeah.
You know, I remember saving up for my first watch, and I still remember my first watch. I believe I may even have that watch stashed away in a box of childhood belongings. Since that time, I have had hundreds of watches, and I have cared for them less and less as time goes on. And today, I'm one of the great number of people who doesn't carry a watch. I just look at my phone when I need to know what time it is, and it makes me sad thinking about that, because at this time, that was a major possession to lose.
Well, yeah, my first watch was given to me by my dad, and I still remember him. It was presented to me. Like, here is your first watch. Like, this is a thing. Like, here is how you put it on, and here is... I always wore it on the wrong wrist. He was like, you should wear it on your right wrist since you're left-handed. And I never understood that reasoning. I was like, but I defer to my left, so I'll just wear the watch. I've always worn a watch on my left hand, which confuses people. But I don't wear a watch either. Even though now, I don't know if you've heard, they have watches that can connect right to your phone. And they actually look like normal watches. So they're making a little bit of a comeback. I think Ralph, the cat, Katso would be proud. I don't know like how I'm tying this into the story, but the long and short of it is the cat breaks into the art room. There's a incredible chase. Or no, there's no chase in this scene. There's a chase later. Katso just sees the watch, steals the watch, and then Garf gets blamed for the missing watch.
Right.
Because no one likes him.
Right, because he's the outsider.
He does find Ralph's motorcycle, though.
Right. Now, this happened. Does that happen before or after Ralph talks to him the first time?
Before.
Right.
He finds the motorcycle, and Ralph's like, okay, now I've got to get out of here. And that's when he starts being like, okay, I know where the watch is. This right. is my bargaining chip.
He talks to Garf when Garf is alone, reveals the fact that he can talk, reveals the fact that he has a rich inner life, and says, please, Garf, let me out. And Garf is, no way.
Yep.
And I'm always amazed at this in these kinds of stories, because I feel like if an animal talked to me, that would be game over. It's like, yeah. Oh, suddenly I realize this is a sentient creature. I must treat it with all the due respect I treat any other other person. You know, it's a strange thing to me. It's sort of like, you know, it's the Scully problem in X-Files. The minute you get confirmation that there actually are extraterrestrials in the world, or that there actually is mystical agents in the world, how do you continue to be a skeptic?
Right. Once that domino has been knocked over.
Yeah, but no, Garf doesn't want to lose his pet.
Right. I would say that if a mouse in my home just suddenly talked to me, the first thing's happening is I'm just going to throw up, like right there. I'm going to throw up and I'm going to like scream a lot. Like I will not be coherent. I'm probably like going to fall. And then like only after like a while will I like my breathing return to normal and I'll be able to like talk with the mouse. It's an amazing thing. And I can understand like in the first book, it gets treated as a little bit mundane. Like the boy, it's kind of like when you read about people who like have like psychic experiences. And at first it's like, and then like all of a sudden your brain is like, nope, this is totally normal. And they're like, and I was immediately bored with being able to bend the spoons. But it's kind of portrayed that way in the first book. The boy is like, oh my gosh, you can talk? Oh, wow. Okay, well, now we're friends. In this book, it's like, huh, you can talk. He's like, yeah, let me out of the cage. He's like, nah. He's like, I can ride that motorcycle. And the boy's like, pfft. He's like, please, I know where your watch is. I can tell you where your watch is. The boy's like, nah, that won't do me any good. He's like, I can clear your name for you. And Garth's like, no, I'm just going to leave you in the cage. And it takes Katso breaking back into the art room and Ralph goading him into knocking the cage off the shelf for Ralph to escape the cage. Like he is definitely like this has to be orchestrated entirely by our hero.
Yes. And there's one last great Lewis Darling full page illustration of Katso lunging for Ralph in a explosion of wires and tacks and paint and tools. And it's a great picture.
That really is a cool shot. It gets there's a lot of motion in that shot. He almost looks like a T-Rex the way he's like on his like hind legs. Yeah. He's standing on. It's an interesting picture because he's clearly standing on the counter knocking stuff off, but the counter is not drawn.
Yeah.
So it's just this cat suspended in midair. It's a really cool picture. But yeah, Ralph escapes. And this is the thing where if Garf hadn't found the motorcycle, this could still have happened. And then Ralph would just get away.
Yeah.
But except for the fact that Garf eventually points out that Ralph will not be able to ride his motorcycle back home. Because it would be uphill the whole way, and his motorcycle would just wear out before then.
Right. He was concerned about the tread on the tire.
Yeah.
Which is a a very mundane, practical concern, considering Ralph is somehow able to motivate this motorcycle simply by going...
Yep. There is a... there's a level of magic here who's, as we discussed in the last book, the boundaries aren't defined. We don't know where it comes from. But it obviously doesn't extend to like the physical structure of the motorcycle. It simply works to somehow turn these wheels slower or faster depending on the size of the breath a mouse has taken. But yeah, so Garf is like, the motorcycle's not going to make it back to the inn, but if you clear my name, I'll take you back to the inn with me.
And so Ralph has to come up with a plot that, by which Jill, the girl who's lost her watch, will find her watch, and yet it cannot be pinned on Garf.
Right, because if Garf returns the watch, people will be like, you just stole it. So it has to be put someplace that Garf would not have access to otherwise.
And that is, Ralph is able to secret the watch inside the lining of Jill's sleeping bag, right?
Yeah. They take the sleeping bags like to air out. And so he chews a hole and like drags the watch where no human hands could have put it.
Yeah. Now there is a picture here of Ralph curled up inside the Dacron. Inside the lining of this sleeping bag, which is a little bit disturbing to me, because it looks either like Ralph is being born out of a birth canal, or it looks like Ralph is part of a mat of hair drain.
I was gonna say it looks like he fell asleep inside some fat guy's navel.
Well. Everyone look up this picture and tell us what horrors you see.
It's page 165. Yeah, and so like if you weren't holding the book, you might be surprised to find out you're mere pages from the end. Because something else happens. The girls discover Ralph in the sleeping bag and capture him.
Right. It seems momentarily like the book is just going to reset itself.
Yes. This is very similar to like him. There's a scene where he gets captured kind of like this in the first book. In this one, he's rescued by Sam the dog, though, yeah. who helps him get away. Because Sam is a good guy at heart, and he hates Katso more than he loves Ralph, or loves his job. So, because Katso comes back again. Like, Katso's like sneaking around. The cat never goes away. It's like when you can't vanquish the camp cat, it's still going to be there. And so Katso keeps coming back, and Sam helps Ralph get away because he's under a hat. The watch gets returned. There's apologies.
Yeah, there's a lot of plot machinations here that get kind of hand-waved in a few pages. Like, a lot of things have to happen, which are a little bit improbable.
Yeah.
We're going to run into this in the next book. Spoiler. Where at the end of the book something happens, we'll get into it there.
Yeah.
I thought it was highly improbable, but eventually Ralph makes his way back to Garf.
Yeah, they realize this is Garf's mouse that escaped, or they give him to Garf as a replacement mouse, not realizing it's the same mouse. Because it's their way of saying like, we're sorry, we blamed you for the whole watch thing. We do get a little closure on Chum's sad life story. Chum has to chew the bars of his own cage so his teeth don't grow through his own face. And Ralph's like, could you get Chum a piece of wood so he won't have to gnaw his cage to keep his teeth worn down? Like, and he's like, okay, I can rest easy knowing this hamster isn't slowly being driven nuts by having to chew on the metal of his cage.
And then, as you pointed out, the book ends pretty much in mid-conversation.
Yep, there is no ending to this book. I mean, you can take him at their word, and you know that there's a third book in the series, but it literally ends unresolved. Like, literally, it's unresolved.
Right, where Ralph is about to go have a nap and says to Garf, remember, you promised to take me, and Garf said, sure. That's about where we end, so.
Yep, he's like, don't worry. I'll get you back to the inn in one piece and your motorcycle too. And then I turned the page and I was like, well, that's the end of this book about a mouse and a camp. I guess he gets back home. I like the last book, like the ending was extended. Like there were a lot of goodbye. But I guess it's like Garf's not his friend. Like they have a deal, and as long as the deal is the promise is kept, like that's it. But there's no like sad goodbyes or anything because they're not friends.
It's a completely transactionary relationship. And what is, you might make the case that that makes this a somewhat of a revolutionary book for Cleary, because what are the lessons Ralph ultimately learns by running away is he learns that the world is a big, terrible place and that everyone's against you, but nonetheless, you can't be, you can't let yourself just get dragged down the way Chum is. And the best you can hope for are people who you can deal with, you know?
Yeah.
Like he makes a deal with Garf. He makes a deal with Sam. He's not going to have any long lasting friendships out of this, but he gets what he wants. And that's okay. That's kind of, you know, that if his rose colored idea of how happy life on the road has been, has been dashed. Nonetheless, he has a kind of a more of a mature way of navigating the world now.
Yeah. Yeah. Like in the first book, Ralph risks his life, like puts his entire life on the line to make an uncomfortable boy slightly less uncomfortable, like to get an aspirin for a boy. Like it's literally what happens. He's like, I will risk death. I will climb the trellises outside the inn and risk being eaten by birds to get a pill so this boy with a fever, his fever will go slightly down, and so he doesn't have to wait until the morning to get an aspirin. Like that is the plot, and it's because he has a love for this boy, and but it is transactionary because it is his attempt to keep the food coming to his family. Like there's that, like if the humans stop bringing food, we are in trouble. And It almost feels like in this book, there is even a greater barrier between him and humans. It's like not only is it dangerous to be around them, but they cage us, they kill us, and even the ones who are nice to us are only nice to us on a limited basis. So I presume this means that in the third book, he won't have anything to do with people at all.
Now, what is the Garf learns, though, from this book? The You know, if he starts this book as something of an outsider, I mean, he gets vindicated insofar as people accuse him of having stolen a watch, and now they don't believe he stole the watch.
Right.
But other than that, he's not really brought into the fold, the social fold. And what he gets out of the story is permission from the camp counselor to go ahead and be selfish and be a loner and to not feel bad about that.
Yeah, there's no like, I mean, they hint a little bit. Beverly Cleary like drops a few hints that like he's starting to open up a bit and make some friends at camp, but then that's all shut down as soon as the watch disappears and he retreats again and he's ostracized. And since we don't get any kind of real ending to the book, we don't know if this kid's okay. We don't know. We don't know anything. Like we never have enough time with Garf to really form a bond with him. The most we see of him, he's sullen and destructive. And then he's just kind of out of the picture. So I don't know, like of the, well, I guess we'll cover this in the last book, but, he is definitely of Beverly Cleary's child characters, one of the like strangely like least memorable for any good reasons.
Your comparison to Candide is apt because it's an oddly random story. You know, things just kind of happen.
Yeah.
And if the wind had been blowing a different way that day, something else would have happened. It's really episodic and meandering in a way that is hard to understand given that the Ramona books have some of the strongest through lines of any of the Cleary books. And from book to book, they have a strong through line. So at the very same time that she's gearing up to do that, she's also doing books like this and like Socks, which is in some ways an even more crazily random book. I don't know where I'm going with this, except that I guess Beverly Cleary contains multitudes.
I am curious now to discuss Socks with you in our next episode, because it is interesting that we get these two animal books back to back. I guess we had Ribsy and the Mouse and the Motorcycle back to back. And those were two completely contrasting animal style books. So now we'll get to take a look at how she is a decade on with her newest animal style books. There's also a crazy 3-year gap between Runaway Ralph and Socks. So I guess it must have been like the Disney animators going to like the African, like the savannah, to study lions for the Lion King. She must have like spent like those 3 years like really watching cats.
If she had, I believe she had her kids sometime around 1955. So maybe she was dealing with the realities of teenagers in the house. That might have slowed down her output at this point.
Maybe.
I don't know.
She is turning 102 soon. So.
Oh, yeah.
So that's something I believe probably in our Socks episode around that time we will have to. That's 102nd anniversary to celebrate.
Do you ever worry that she's listening to us when we do these podcasts?
I hope she is. I hope she is. I hope this is one of the last things she thinks of. I don't know. I hope she goes to sleep with this in her ear.
Miss Clary, please don't take any of the criticisms we say to heart. We love you very much.
I hope she turns to whoever is caring for her. She's almost 102, and even the most sprightly 102-year-old, I know for a fact, because I know a 102-year-old, still needs daily care, daily help. I hope every night she turns to that person and says, "You know what? I stopped writing. Oh, like almost 2 decades ago, I stopped writing, and finally, it is." My books have found their intended audience, which is two grousing men picking apart a book about a mouse riding a motorcycle at camp, complaining that the ending, it doesn't stick the landing. I hope those are her thoughts. I hope that she's like, good, it was all worth it.
Well, I guess tune in next time.
We'll see if this cat lives up to our expectations.
And we'll see if we can go a little bit shorter than like 2 or 3 months between episodes.
Right.
but please understand, both of us are adult men with many other podcasts to watch after.
So join us next time when we talk about Socks.
Okay.
Isn't that it?
That's it.
This episode's reading was provided by Brad Donaldson. You have been listening to Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast, part of the Incomparable Network. The Incomparable Network. Smart, funny podcasts. For more information, visit theincomparable.com.